Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. Once part of the ATA tribe, you'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we will be talking to one Brian Shelton. Brian is a highly regarded consultant and trainer and has been applying behavioral science for over 10 years, dedicating his time to performance improvement within organizational settings. Brian helps organizations develop meaningful and actionable strategic objectives that successfully align employment performance with the company's desired goals. Using his extensive background in behavior analysis and the application of behavior-based solutions, Brian helps clients create improvement across a variety of business metrics, including company safety, growth, profitability, customer service, vision alignment, leadership development, and culture change. Brian earned his BS in psychology with an emphasis in performance management from Florida State University and his MS in behavior analysis with an emphasis in organizational behavior management from the University of North Texas. He has presented at various organizational and association conferences and has authored articles, blogs, and book chapters, and currently works with Audrey Daniels International. Without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Brian to the show today, who is patiently waiting by in Colorado, USA. Brian, hello, and thank you for making time for us here at Animal Training Academy.
Yeah, of course, Ryan. Thanks so much for having us. I'm excited to be a part of the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely thrilled to have you join us. We've been having requests from our listeners to get someone from your organization, Audrey Daniels, on the show for years now. So apologies, listeners, it's taken me years, but hey, good things take time. Hey, Brian, maybe can you start off just telling us a little bit more about Audrey Daniels International, what you guys do?
Yeah, absolutely. So Audrey Daniels International, or ADI, we've been in business for 40 years. I've only been a part of the organization for six of those, but it started out by Audrey a little over 40 years ago. And he's no longer actually an active employee of ADI, but he's definitely still active as our chairman of the board, and he still comes to work every day in a suit and tie. So it's always, I was there last week and I got to see him, and it's always great to meet, you know, and see one of your great mentors. But for people that don't know what ADI does, we are consultants that focus on teaching behavior science and implementing behavior science strategies in organizations today. So what we do is we use the science of behavior analysis, or behavior sciences, I'll call it, in all of our consulting and training. And so my focus at ADI is mainly driven towards safety, company safety, whether that's looking at the processes and the systems in place that influence people's behavior and decision making, or the leadership. And so I focus in a lot of what we call high hazard industries, which are things like transportation, mining, manufacturing, chemical plants, power plants, things like that. But ADI is in general, we work with many other industries than that. And we also focus in other business metrics, such as like sales and quality metrics, you know, increasing production. We do things like performance pay strategies and then just general good leadership development. One of the things that I absolutely love about the organization and what we do is we help people understand and apply behavior science so that they can become better leaders and have better influence on people's behavior. So that's one of our, it's kind of one of our goals as an organization is teach other organizations to apply behavior science to promote what we call discretionary effort to help drive business results.
You're awesome. And I feel like all of us behavior nerds, whether we're working for Aubrey Daniels International or humans or dogs or horses or zoo animals, whatever, we're always looking at everything going, well, it's always behavior. There's always behavior science there, and it's whether you know it and are applying it strategically and intentionally and well. So it's nice to see that hopefully this company that you work for is one of a growing number of organizations that are appreciating the benefit of applying the science of behavior. And I'm excited about doing this particular episode, speaking about the requests we've had from audience members, but also just for myself, because this podcast show is about all earthlings. We talk about canines a lot. We talk about horses. We talk about zoo animals, but we are learners as well. I'm a learner. Brian's a learner. You all out there are learners and operators on your environment. So I'm excited that today we get to geek out on the human earthling learners and ways and learn from Brian's knowledge and experience of how he takes that to what he does. So Brian, I'm curious to learn a little bit more about you as a person. Can you take us back to and share some of your journey? How did you first realize that behavior analysis was something you wanted to follow and helping organizations and leaders become more efficient and effective using behavior science?
Yeah, definitely. So as you mentioned earlier, I started my undergraduate work at Florida State University. And in the beginning, you know, for the first several years, I kind of jumped around a lot in what I was studying and what I was really interested in. I thought I wanted to be a psychiatrist for a little while. And so I was taking pre-med classes and I was taking a lot of psychology classes. And in one of those, I learned about organizational industrial psychology, and I thought that was really interesting. But the more I looked at it, I was studying a lot of biology, I was studying a lot of genetics, and a lot of the natural sciences, and I wanted a way to connect the dots, I guess, with using what I was learning in psychology and you know the science, the more natural sciences. And I one day I was just luckily talking to my advisor. And she said, hey, you know, we have a professor here. His name is Dr. John Bailey, and he's a behavior analyst. And, you know, what you're interested in is, you know, right in the line with what he does. So, you know, maybe you should schedule a meeting with him. And your audience might recognize Dr. Bailey. He wrote the book with Mary Broach on How Dogs Learn. So if you guys have read that, that's one of his books. But that meeting was a defining moment in my life. I sat down with John and he told me about, you know, behavior analysis and what it could do and how, you know, the environment, you know, influences behavior. And, you know, it does it from the time we're born to the time we pass on, right? It's how we decide what we're going to do from day-to-day basis. It's the environment. So he told me a little bit about the science and he told me about, a set of courses that he put together called his performance management track. And that was dedicated to learning about and applying behavior science in organizations. And based off that meeting, I was lucky enough that he accepted me into the program. And it was excellent because I think, you know, it was several classes. It was like four classes or six classes long working with Dr. Bailey. And we learned about how to apply behavior science from everything from, you know, influencing organizations to training his dogs to run agility courses and everything in between. So that was really cool. And then when I graduated from Florida State, I went to University of North Texas, where you actually recently had Dr. Jesus Rosales on the podcast. And so I took a couple classes with him. And, you know, my one regret at UNT was not being able to just stay there and spend more time at UNT, because it was, you know, at that time, it was some of the best professors in behavior science. And the learning environment that they created was just extremely reinforcing. But I did a lot of things, and I worked with several different professors. I worked with Dr. Sigrid Glenn in her undergraduate teaching program, where she allowed us as students to teach undergraduate classes. And we worked with one another to learn from each other and write course materials and things like that. I got to work with Dr. Rick Smith, and I did a lot of work with him out at a state school that served adults with severe developmental disabilities. We had a group there that functioned as an actual clinical psychologist. So they would call, you know, some of us, and we would go and do, we would do functional assessments. We would write behavior plans. We would train staff. We functioned as a true, one of their clinical psychologists in that state school. So that was really neat. And I worked with Dr. Cloyd Hyten, and he's where I continued my study of organizational behavior management. And I ended up working with him and running a student-based consulting firm, where we got to do just, a bunch of projects at organizations. We did things like, we did interviews and assessments, and we ran projects, including things like developing performance scorecards and linking those to pay. And so it was just a really exciting time. A cool side note. So Dr. Hyten is now a few years after I graduated, he ended up leaving the university to work at Aubrey Daniels International. And so he and I are actually colleagues now. And so it's fun to get together, in a completely different relationship and work together. So it's a really neat experience. But after that, when I graduated with my master's degree, I did some work with adults with developmental disabilities for a few years. And then I worked with a small consulting group out locally. I was living in Nashville, Tennessee at the time, and I worked with a small consulting group there, and we did a lot of strategic planning and coaching on developing skill sets for professional service firms, such as sales behaviors and things like that. And I worked there for 7 years, but when I got the opportunity to work for ADI, I jumped at it. I jumped at that opportunity because, of course, Aubrey, he wrote the book that we read in Dr. Bailey's class, and that was the book that, changed my life. I knew, that we could apply behavior science in organizations just to make them better, both for the organization, but for the employees. And that was pretty great. And so I've been with ADI for now 6 years and going strong.
And do you feel that when you jump jobs learners,
yeah.
So you're working with different learners, the word job doesn't resonate with me. I found myself hesitating there.
Yeah.
But do you feel that it was kind of the same job in a different context? Or did you feel like you completely shifted gears when you jumped over from working with people with severe disabilities and learning challenges to organizations?
Yeah, it's so funny, talking to my clients when I tell them that, I did that for a while. Some people ask how could that relate to our organization? And other clients immediately go, oh, I totally see how that relates to our organization, right? Working with adults. But the interesting thing is, right, and you mentioned it earlier, it's all behavior. And if you can understand behavior science and you understand, what you're trying to accomplish, then you can, help create an environment and support an environment that either, teaches people how to have, coping skills and teaches people how to clean their house and things like that. Or, the same science applies for teaching people how to be a good business owner or how to better develop their leadership skills.
And so if you could go back to sitting in Dr. Rosales Ruiz's class in the University of North Texas, and you could look forward to where you are now, would that earlier version of Brian go, oh yeah, that's where I see myself going. That's where I think I'm going to be. Or has kind of your career just changed? Has your expectations changed? Did you know what kind of opportunities were available to you once you had finished?
Yeah. So I knew I wanted to apply the behavior analysis in organizations. And that's why I went to University of North Texas, was to, for the opportunity to study with Dr. Hyten. I knew that's exactly what I wanted to do. But at that time I was newly married, and you know, the other contingencies opened up where it was like, I need to get a job real quick after graduating. And, the recruitment strategies for working with adults with developmental disabilities was a little bit better than with companies that apply behavior science in organizations. And so, you know, I knew I wanted to do that kind of work, but I thought, you know, I just need to start working so I can, have money for my family and be able to support myself and my new wife. I took that job, but it quickly became apparent to me that, you know, I was doing the work, but it wasn't what I loved. I only worked for that company that I worked with for 3 years. And I thought, I need to, you know, I really need to get back into, you know, trying to do OBM or organizational behavior management, because, it's a much more meaningful career. And, this applying behavior science in organizations just to, you know, help leaders and to help employees, with whatever they're going after, whatever business metric I could help them with. That's where I wanted to be. So yeah, I knew I wanted to be there. I just took a really long and convoluted route to get there.
Hey, I'm sure you took all of the approximations required to get to your current location.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, so we like stories here at the Animal Training Academy podcast show. And when we caught up last week or the week before, whenever it was, to discuss what we're going to talk about on this episode today, we shared some funny stories from both of our experiences. So I'm curious to know, because I appreciate being an animal training professional, how sometimes my wife perceives some of the things that I do or say as me treating her like an animal. I say treating her like a learner, and I'd be silly not to, but it doesn't always land that way. If we were to ask your wife what it's like to be married to someone who does applied behavior analysis and helps organizations with human behavior for a living, what would she say?
Oh man, it's such a good question. I would hope that she would say something like, that I provide a lot of positive reinforcement, and that, you know, I create a nurturing environment to, you know, support the things that she finds very reinforcing. But truth be told, there's probably a little bit of a double-edged sword there, where, you know, I definitely, try to provide a lot of positive reinforcement, but, you know, my behavior, in the last 20 years of consulting has been shaped to, when I hear problems, I want to come up immediately with solutions. And, I'm sure there are times in which she just thinks, boy, I just wish he would listen. But right now, you know, he wants to jump in and solve a problem. So definitely a little bit of a double-edged sword. But I will say, I've used the science with her and applied positive reinforcement with her. You know, I taught her how to rock climb, for example, for one of our first dates. And, I use shaping because it's a great learning tool. You teach somebody with a lot of positive reinforcement so that, you know, not only do they learn the skill quickly, but they, enjoy doing the activity because it's associated with a lot of reinforcement. And so I've used that. I even wrote that as an article, and it's on the ADI website. And I remember being, so excited, and I sent it to her, and I'm like, hey, look, I posted this article. It's about me teaching you how to rock rock climb. It's so cool. And when she read it, she was like, you know, next time, maybe just, you know, ask me before you write an article about me, which, of course, I think looking back is completely fair. So, you know, I think our marriage is one that, you know, is good. And you know, even if somebody knows about the science and knows about positive reinforcement, when you provide positive reinforcement and you sincerely mean it, then, you know, people are going to be receptive to it, even though, you know, they might go, oh, I wonder if he's, you know, trying to reinforce my behavior.
So to tell us now then what you do on a daily basis, what does a day in the life of you look like?
Absolutely. And so we typically, the way our client relationships work with, but the way it typically starts off with is doing an assessment and actually going into, you know, an organization who may be struggling with their safety metrics, or in the last several years, it's just been, we want to improve, right? We're already really good, but we want to get better. So come in and help us out. And so we start off with doing an assessment, and we look at just what does the current environment look like from a worker perspective, so an hourly employee, and all the way up through leadership. And we look at the systems and the processes, and we look at work, and we go to meetings and see how they're run. And we just kind of get a comprehensive picture of, you know, what does the environment look like that people work in, right? And what's encouraging behavior from day to day, moment to moment, the good and the bad. And we figure out with the organization what are we working on? What's the result? What does success look like? What does this relationship look like that's going to win? So, you know, typically in my case, it's you know, we want to improve safety metrics or improve safety culture. Safety culture has been a big topic lately, which is just you know, a way to describe you know, how people interact within that workplace in regards to safety and how safety is promoted throughout that organization. And so we come up with our metric of what we're going to focus on. And then we figure out what are the key behaviors that we need to pinpoint and to drive to achieve the organization's goal. So if they want to reduce injuries or reduce fatalities, well, what do those operators on that front line need to do daily to make sure that they keep themselves safe and keep each other safe? And then once we've pinpointed those behaviors really clearly, I move levels and say, okay, great. Now that I have that, well, what do the supervisors need to do to support those behaviors? And I pinpoint out the specific behaviors that supervisors need to do. And then I move up the organizational ladder until we get all the way to the plant manager or even a corporate office on, you know, what do the senior executives need to do to support, you know, those desired results. And once we've pinpointed all those behaviors, we've looked at, you know, what's getting in the way of people doing those behaviors. You know, what are some of the undesired behaviors that they might be doing instead? And we figure out what's maintaining those. We start a couple things. We look at the systems and the processes, you know, working within that organization, and we start making, you know, refinements to those to make sure that the systems and the processes support the behaviors we're looking for, support those desired behaviors. And then we do a lot of, like I said earlier, training with leadership on how to apply behavior science and how to apply positive reinforcement and how to make sure that, you know, what they say and do on a daily basis supports the desired results or the things that they need, that they want to accomplish. And so we train them in behavior science. And then typically what it looks like after that point is there's a lot of follow-up. There's a lot of one-on-one coaching. There's a lot of me being, or my colleagues being on site, you know, listening into meetings, listening into conversations and providing direct feedback so that we can, you know, teach people how to have better influence on each other. So that's typically what it looks like.
Yeah, it sounds like what we do with dogs and zoo animals and horses, just potentially with a lot more resources behind it than sometimes we see.
Yeah.
Do you find that you spend time teaching the humans, the leaders, the teams about the science, or do you just go in and give them information about the practical steps that you recommend they take?
No, we always teach leaders about the science. And the reason we do that is we don't want to teach them a bag of tricks like that, you know, that might work in one situation that, but under another situation where, you know, the functions of whatever behaviors we're seeing are different won't work. And so teaching people about behavior science and how to apply science in general gives them a skill set to see when they try to do something different and it doesn't work, well, what should they try next, right? So taking a true scientific approach to where you run an experiment, you run with, you run with intervention A, and if intervention A produces your results, great. And if it doesn't, well, let's go back to the drawing board and let's pick up intervention B or C. I always try to give them a history of the science and teach them just the fundamentals, kind of the, you know, the ABC analysis of science. So that they are constantly thinking after that, okay, if I'm trying to prompt this behavior, for example, okay, what do I need to do? What do good antecedents look like? You know, it occurs right before the behavior. It's specific. I've got the right tools and the right resources, those kinds of things. And then once that behavior, that desired behavior is occurring, the leader needs to learn to shift their focus to, now that I see that desired behavior, what am I going to do to deliver positive reinforcement to that behavior? And so without knowing at least the basics or the fundamentals of the science, you know, they'll miss the critical shifting of, you know, antecedents to consequences, or, you know, how to add positive reinforcement, or when they're giving positive feedback, you know, they should, you know, are they also creating alignment with other systems, or are there competing contingencies that still might be promoting an undesired behavior? And if there are those, what are they going to do about them? So we look at the science a lot.
Man, if I got a job at an organization, not as an applied behavior analysis, I'm not qualified as applied behavior analysis, but if I got a job at an organization where they started to talk to me about ABCs and positive reinforcement, it would blow my mind. I think it's happened once, and there wasn't an organization, a big organization, that does animal training as its core value proposition offering. I find that when I work with animal trainers, they kind of come back to me eventually and say, you know, all of the stuff you've been talking to me about, I kind of like, does it apply to my children? do you get like the managers come to you and say, will this work with my dog at home?
Definitely. Matter of fact, I always recommend start with your dog and your kids and your spouse, and start with the people that are going to have the best responses, right? Because there's nothing better than teaching your dog to sit with a clicker and they wag their tail because, you know, you taught them with positive reinforcement, right? So it's a really neat way to see behavior science in action. Same thing with kids and learning, and just making, you know, subtle shifts in the environment and seeing how much it can change, you know, the outlook for a kid on something, or, you know, the way they go about doing something. So, yeah, I always recommend that any leader that, you know, we work with start to apply it in every aspect of their life. Because the more you apply it in different settings and with different learners, the easier it becomes to apply the science in general, right? So we call that generalization. If you learn how to apply behavior science, you can do that in any number of, you know, organizations or home, or, you know, out in the backyard with your pup.
And can you potentially share a favorite story from kind of teaching a specific individual or a team the laws of the science that we're talking about, and kind of how they've gone away and come back with something that's really impressed you?
Yeah, I can. So one of my clients, this is a corporate safety team for a large mining organization, and when they first started out, you know, as you could imagine in a mining organization where, you know, there was a lot of a past history of command and control, of punishing behavior you didn't want to see, of rules that if you break it you're fired, and all those kinds of things that sound a lot like, you know, punishment and driving behavior through negative reinforcement. When I first started working with that organization, there was definitely a little bit of apprehensiveness of, we don't even know if when we start to apply this and we start to teach this that people will do anything with it. But that, you know, it's kind of the first rule of shaping where you say, well, let's, you know, what's the first step look like? And so we got them to, you know, identify what's the smallest step that they could take, and what they could help other leaders take to, you know, improve, and shift their style from more of that kind of that do it or else, or that negative reinforcement approach to a more positive reinforcement approach where we're recognizing safe behaviors and we're recognizing when people are doing the right things. And one of the things that we worked on was actually just simply running an effective pre-shift meeting. So, you know, what that looks like is, you know, when the workers came in for the day, they all sat down together and they talked about what they were going to do during the day and what they could, you know, and what they could do to keep themselves safe and what they could do to keep others safe. And the supervisors or their leads would run those meetings. And as you can imagine, there was a lot of variability in how effective or efficient those meetings were run. And so we focused in on just things like in that meeting, ask open-ended questions to make sure that the people are listening and they're understanding today's assignments. And you know, instead of telling them about what hazards they were going to face, try asking, you know, what are they going to be concerned about when they go out on you know, on that job. And what are they going to look for, right? What hazards will they look for? And what are they going to do to mitigate those hazards once they recognize them? And really quickly, you could see that organization, even all the way up to the corporate level, you know, was just completely enthralled with the science works. And a lot of their sites just, you know, almost did a, you know, 180 degree turn in how they were going about managing the frontline behaviors and the supervisor behaviors and things like that.
That's pretty impressive, and seemingly a small little change to just modify the way you're asking or change to asking questions or different questions. Cool. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Right on.
So before we move on, just can you share it with everyone where they can go to find out more about Aubrey Daniels International?
Yeah, aubreydaniels.com is our website. They can also find me on LinkedIn, and all of the other consultants have LinkedIn pages and things like that. But on our website, we've got a ton of articles. We write articles all the time. All the consultants do. We've got some videos and just other things that people might find useful. And one of the things that I think we do really well is talk about the science in ways that people that don't know about the science can immediately learn something from. So all of our articles are written for people that are just you know, in good old fashioned leadership, you know, positions. And with no background in behavior science, but they look at they can read our articles and pick out something that will be useful. So I think that's probably the best resource for the listeners.
Yeah. And we had a member in our community areas within our membership ask about safety in their workplace. And I put the word safety into your search area in your website, and it a little bit overwhelming in a good way, the amount of resources that were available to me for free to kind of go in there and find something that was relevant for the challenge I was facing. So with my limited but positive experience trawling through the ADA website, there's a lot on there, isn't there?
Oh yeah, there's definitely a lot on there, and a lot of the, you know, Aubrey Daniels and Dr. Judy Agnew, and we've got several others that have written books, and we have all the books available on our website. But yeah, for that listener who's interested in safety, Safe by Accident is one of the best books on applying behavior science and safety that you could get, and it also it points out all of the typical pitfalls that you see organizations fall into. Such as just over anteceding people or relying heavily on punishment to drive and negative reinforcement to drive safe behaviors, and just the havoc that can cause within the organization. So that'd be an excellent resource for that listener.
Awesome. And we'll link to all of this in the show notes as well. Hey, Brian, thanks for sharing everything so far. We love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys, as we like to call them. Moving forward, though, I'd love to talk about five things that we can draw from your work and apply to what we do as professional animal trainers. You and I discussed coming up with five things we can do to become better animal training leaders. Can you share what you've come up with us?
Yeah, of course. And so the first thing I did, you know, when you think about, changing people's behavior, the first thing to look at is what are they doing well, right? What are they doing well that they could deliver reinforcement for? So I want to pick out a couple, several things that I think animal trainers naturally do that other leaders, that I would love it if other leaders learned quickly. And then I've got some ideas of just kind of rapid fire. Well, my fifth idea is just here are some things if you're wondering about how to apply behavior science with human learners, then here are some of Brian's best the tips to move forward with first. But the first thing that I think is important is the statement that the rat is always right, which I think most of your learners will know and listeners will know. But for us, in organizations, I don't quite describe it with talking about the rat, but I typically say something like everybody's behavior makes sense to them when they do a behavior, or someone's behavior is always telling you something. To make the same point as the rat is always right. And what we're saying there, of course, is just, the environment influences what people do, right? People behave in ways that are consistent with what the environment supports. So, think about all the behaviors that you see either in organizations or just in daily life that are, unsafe or undesired or unethical, immoral, all those kinds of things that, you see people do on a daily basis. And you think in organizations, they see those kinds of things and they go, why does this, why would an employee, stick their hand in a moving machine kind of thing? It's against our company values. We state that it's, you shouldn't do that. We go around telling people not to do that, but people do it anyway. It's all about the environment and how the environment influences our behavior. I'll give you an example. One of the organizations that I've done some work with, right before I started, they unfortunately had a fatality in their maintenance department. When I got on site, I went to the maintenance department and I started talking to the crews that worked in that department, and just said, hey, what are some reasons what are some ways in which that behavior might have been encouraged? What's going on there? Why would anybody, do something that, puts themselves at risk? And it became just glaringly obvious that there were some things that the organization did that were basically creating an environment that supported taking shortcuts and supported anything that the employee could do, any maintenance people could do to save time. And what it was is they had. The maintenance department, this organization has two shifts. They run two 12-hour shifts. And the organization had cut the second shift, the maintenance workers on second shift to basically bare bones. They had taken it from, they had basically cut like 50 or 60% of their workforce on second shift. And so the people on first shift basically said, look, if I can't get something done right now, right, if I can't get the work done today, there's a snowball effect where not only do I have to fix that thing tomorrow, but I have 12 hours of full scheduled work tomorrow, and I'm going to have to fix other things. From the worker's perspective, it was just, it was a badly designed environment, right? The environment was designed so that it encouraged anything that the employee could do to take a shortcut. And of course, it's really unfortunate for that worker. And it's a bad environment. So you think, okay, well, the question has to, you have to ask the question, well, who has the most influence on the work environment? Who controls that? And of course, the answer is leadership does. Like leadership makes those decisions. Leadership provides the tools and the resources and, the things that people work around and behave around. And a lot of organizations, inadvertently design systems and processes that promote undesired behavior or end up actually punishing desired behavior, or at least put it under extinction. And so, you know, we have to talk about how the environment influences people's behavior. And you know, animal trainers, you guys already get that. You already get that, you know, the environment, you know, the behavior is being influenced by the environment. And without sufficient enough reinforcement in an environment, that the behavior is going to drift. And so that's one of those things that I have to work with leaders to get to recognize. And it's pretty hard sometimes for them to, you know, take that kind of ownership on, you know, they're the ones that have the direct influence on the environment. And it's even harder to get them to recognize that if they want that environment to change, then they've got to do something different first, right? The workers are doing exactly what the environment is supporting. So if they want another behavior, they've got to rearrange the environment to support that that more desired behavior.
Well, I like the saying, the red is always right. And I like that we're talking about that with regards to human learners. And just, I'm thinking that we could even call this podcast episode, this specific episode, Everyone's Behavior Makes Sense to Them. I think that's a really powerful takeaway. And so I'm curious to you as the listeners out there, you know, if you wanted to comment on that on any of our postings on social media or anything about how that resonates with you, because that's something that I think I'm going to take away from today's episode, that this idea, and it's going to be rolling around in my mind. But no, continue on. I mean, and that's all fantastic contributions so far.
Excellent. Well, the other thing I think is that I think animal trainers in general do extremely well, that I have to just really work with leadership to adopt, is animal trainers rely on positive reinforcement, even though you can create behavior change with negative reinforcement. You know, think of with positive reinforcement, right? Positive reinforcement is they get something. Something is added to their environment. That is the click and treat after the dog sits. That's, you know, getting something that's desirable, a desirable outcome or a desirable consequence. With negative reinforcement, you're escaping or avoiding something you don't want. And my favorite just kind of layman's example of negative reinforcement is how people typically change their driving patterns when a police officer is behind them. You know, I always ask that in my classes and just say, hey, what kinds of things do you do differently when there's a police officer behind you? And there's all these behaviors that people start to report that they do. They sit up straighter. You know, they put their cell phone down. They pay a lot more attention to their speedometer. You know, they may end up slowing down a little bit to match the speed limit. They use their turn signals if they're going to get over, and all those kinds of things. And then I said, okay, so what do you do when the police officer turns off? Oh, I go back to normal driving, right? So you have this increase of all these behaviors, you know, that we would consider kind of safe driving behaviors. But they go away as soon as they've produced that, they've successfully produced the cop going away, right? They've avoided that ticket. And so that's kind of my quick and dirty with everyday examples between the difference. And here's the thing, I'm sure your listeners know, either through you know, through history of working through organizations and things like that, but many organizations and actually leaders rely on managing behavior through negative reinforcement. Right. We call it, it's so common. We just call it like, it's the do it or else approach of management, right? Where, you know, a manager walks around and when they're walking through the, you know, where the employees are, they're looking for people that are doing errors, you know, they're looking for errors. They're looking for people that aren't doing what they should be doing so that they can then, you know, manage people's behavior. And I threw that up in air quotes, but yeah, by managing behavior, what I mean by that is, you know, they get to reprimand them, right? They get to write them up. They get to send them home. They get to, you know, personally attack them. They get to yell at them, those kinds of things. And what happens when, you know, the employees are working? Well, then a leader who uses that more negative reinforcement approach doesn't have anything to do. They typically just ignore the people that are doing the right kinds of job, you know, the right kinds of behaviors. So, you know, they're literally just walking around looking for the exception. And so just like we do with, you know, he's driving behind us, learners quickly learn how to successfully escape or avoid their boss, right? By either looking busy while the boss is around, or they find ways to hide, which happens in organizations all the time, where you know a worker will pick up the phone and have a fake phone call, or will simply walk into another room, or do something like that. Which, of course, when you think about productivity, that's in the opposite of producing what the organization truly wants. And so behaviorally, there are two really interesting things when organizations or people over rely on the use of negative reinforcement for managing behavior. The first one is just the patterns of behavior it produces, right? It produces patterns that only people do just enough so that they're left alone, right? They do just enough to escape or avoid consequences they don't want to happen. So there's a ton of behavior and a ton of things that are left over. And so the organization is not getting the best out of their people. They're getting just enough. And the second thing that's really interesting with an over-reliance on negative reinforcement is just the side effects that negative reinforcement produces. So the direct effect is that it increases behavior, right? Negative reinforcement increases behavior. But there are a ton of side effects that using negative reinforcement also produces. And a good way to think about it is like the side effects that drug companies now have to talk about when they introduce a new medicine, right? They tell you about what the medicine does, but they also mention the side effects, and they usually have somebody who can talk really fast about the side effects. But imagine a new drug is coming to the market, and it's the direct effect is that it's going to reduce the length of a migraine. But the side effects sound something like, well, your hair's going to fall out, you're going to become incontinent, you're going to lose your motor function, you're going to not be able to sleep anymore, and eventually you'll go blind, right? All these side effects are produced, but it's going to reduce your migraines. And you got to think, well, how many people would actually sign up for that, right? And my guess is not very many people are going to be willing to take that drug simply because of the side effects it produces. Well, negative reinforcement produces side effects, things like decreased morale, decreased teamwork, right? Because why would you feel good about coming into an organization where your boss is just looking for the one time you screw up and so he or she can yell at you? And why would you volunteer for anything? Because that'd just be setting yourself up for, getting into trouble more often, which we're not going to do that. You see a ton of suppression of communication, where employees simply don't want to have conversations with their boss and talk about the things that are really important in the organization because they're afraid. You see things like higher turnover, emotional responding, and it actually, negative reinforcement can create the desire to retaliate as a subset of behaviors. I'll give you an example of that is really interesting. So this was in the recent news. This isn't a client, but it was in the recent news, and it was a worker at a food manufacturing plant. And this person was going to quit their job. And the way they decided that they were going to quit their job was to stand up over the food as it was being processed and urinated on the food as it passed by. And that was his way of quitting. And of course, he was arrested and it made, at least national news in North America about this, how egregious this behavior was. But when they asked the guy, what made you do this? His basic answer was, look, I was managed so poorly. I wanted the company to feel just a little bit of how bad they made me feel on a day-to-day basis. I wanted to give them just a little bit of that feeling. And the only way I could think about it, a way to get back at them was to hit them in their pocketbook. That's harsh, right? That's a harsh way to retaliate against the way that he was being managed. And over-relying on negative reinforcement, elicits that kind of responding. It elicits emotional responding. And the emotional responding can last for years. I know Karen Pryor, I wrote an article about being a poison Q. She's the one who kind of coined that term poison Q, where if you use, negative reinforcement to get behavior going, you'll pay for that, right? The responding is, it's not as clean, and the animal's not as happy when you're working with them. And luckily you guys have picked that up a long time ago, but, a lot of the leaders that I work with simply haven't picked that up yet. And they think, walking around with the hammers and yelling at people and things like that's a good idea. So you guys have, there's a lot to learn from you guys in that respect.
Yeah, and I feel like all of the listeners of this show can appreciate a working environment that they've been in, that some of the things that you've talked about just now, they can relate to. If not all of them, at least some of them. I found myself even, it doesn't happen much in podcast episodes, to be honest with you, drifting off with my own thoughts about my own situations in my life where I've been in situations. And I found myself thinking about at the end of a job interview when they say, "Do you have any questions for us?" What kind of behavior change strategies do you use in your organizations to deal with undesirable behaviors? And I can just imagine some blank faces.
Yes, exactly. But it's a great question. I've worked under a leader who was, he relied heavily on kind of that negative reinforcement punishment strategy to manage his employees. And I remember I gave him bad news once. In my entire career at that organization. But I learned my lesson after once, because he literally picked up a chair and threw it. And I thought, okay, well, if you're going to have that kind of reaction, I am going to do everything that I can do to, to not work with you, to, not be in the same room as you, to escape or avoid you. It took me one term, and I learned that. And that lesson, it still lasts. That was probably 8 or 10 years ago. And that lesson is still with me today.
Yeah, that's intense. And I remember seeing one of the contestants of a show called Married at First Sight here in Australasia grab one of his new wife cheated on him with one of the other contestants, and they one of the other participants of the experiment, as they would say. And he actually got a toilet brush and rubbed it in the toilet bowl and filmed it and sent it to other people. It was a mayhem. It kind of reminded me of peeing on food on the conveyor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Continue, Brian. This is all fascinating. I'm loving it.
Yeah, right on. So the other thing, another point that I think animal trainers do extremely well is the precision in which you deliver positive reinforcement. Because even the slightest delays in reinforcement delivery, and you're not reinforcing the behavior you wanted to. Right. We used to have an animal trainer who used to come in when I first started working with ADI, and she did a lot of animal training with dolphins and things like that. And she would talk about that if you weren't exactly precise in your delivery of reinforcement, when they jumped, for example, the height you clicked at was the height you're going to get next time. So if you didn't deliver it perfect, if you didn't deliver it right when they were cresting to go through the hoop or whatever, the animal trainer was trying to get the dolphin to do, then you had to go back, right? And get that behavior occurring again, because the reinforcers said, "Oh, jump a little bit lower that time." And so animal trainers do that extremely well with being very precise in your reinforcement delivery. But if you look at the way most reinforcement or just consequences in general are delivered in organizations today from leaders, they're typically very uncertain. They're typically very vague, and they're typically very delayed, right? And none of those things work well when it comes to, having influence on somebody's behavior. Just think about all the, weird patterns of behavior that you could produce. If you were slow in your reinforcement delivery, or you withheld reinforcement with animals, right? They would get so fed up, they'd just walk off. But you hear all the time when I first start working with a leader, you know, they'll you know, say, observe a meeting, you know, somebody running a meeting, and you know, a week later they'll say, hey, you know, that was a really good job running that meeting in there. And they think they've delivered positive reinforcement, but I don't call that positive reinforcement. I call that being nice, because there's no way that actually is going to reinforce any particular behavior that happened in that meeting. You know, the person running the meeting probably did hundreds of behaviors in that meeting. And so because it was vague, because it was slow, more than likely the performer, that they're not going to know exactly what they should do again, what to repeat. And so you're not going to get any strengthening of behavior over time. So there, and by definition, it's not positive reinforcement. I listened to that interview you did with Joan Orr, and part of it that I just completely hands down agree with her approach is she talked about the being very precise in your language, right? Even if you can get feedback down to one word, that'll be more powerful than grabbing somebody and talking to them for 10 minutes, right? And trying to provide feedback, you know, especially when you're trying to influence that moment to moment, decision making. So one of the things that I work with leaders on right in the beginning is how to be quick, precise, and helpful in their feedback. And so, you know, I want a conversation to be 30 seconds to a minute long, and that's a two-way conversation that includes dialogue. I want that conversation to be very precise, so that it tells the person that they're coaching exactly either what they did that you liked and or what they could do next time that would be even better, right? So, if they can do that really well, it'll be, you know, it's helpful to the performer. They're going to know, you know, oh, okay, I can do that again. I can ask those kinds of open-ended questions again, or I could try running the meeting from a, you know, using an agenda. I think that might work better for me. And so, you know, that's something that animal trainers do really well that I find that I have to coach up a lot is, you know, the precision in delivering reinforcement and connecting especially with humans, finding, creating or increasing the value of more natural consequences or natural reinforcers, right? Getting leaders to talk about why that behavior is important or what's in it for the performer. And I spend a lot of time working with leaders on, you know, getting them to recognize consequences as positive reinforcers and making them important to the whoever they're coaching or whoever they're leading, is make those consequences important.
I'm enjoying you blowing our horns as animal chickens. This is awesome. What else do we do?
Yeah, right? I got one more. So yeah, you guys are good. I got one more. So the other one is animal trainers use shaping and chaining better than most people in organizations, right? You think about leadership behaviors, even something simple like giving feedback, that behavior is extremely complex in nature, right? You've got to know, for example, there are some situations in which you'd want to give only positive reinforcement. There are other situations in which the performer might be doing something right, but you saw something that needed to be corrected and you thought, oh, I need to do this other behavior. You know, I need to give them some constructive feedback instead, right? Leadership behaviors are just really complex. Animal trainers have done a really good job with taking the concept of shaping, and you are able to produce just, animals doing all sorts of just really cool stuff. And that's something that, I use personally, when I'm coaching other leaders on even something as simple as how to give influential positive feedback, I'm using shaping, where I start where their performer's at and I talk about, okay, you're here. What's one thing that we can do different? What's one thing that you could do to maybe, make your feedback more influential, or I'll give them some ideas. And then build in repetition so that they get to practice anything that I recommend, as far as like maybe a different approach to take or how they could, coach somebody different, give them a suggestion and then build in repetition. Animal trainers, that's, you guys build in tons of repetition so that the learner can learn quickly. In organizations, you don't see that very often. I use shaping from everything from, like I said, teaching leaders to get positive positive feedback to, you know, teaching my wife how to rock climb, you know, on one of our first dates. And so the same skill it takes to, you know, to train animals to do a, you know, a particular task or, you know, is the same one that will work when you're working with human performers, you know, and it's a very useful skill to have.
Yeah, and Joan Orr and the team of tech teach professionals do it exceptionally well. I agree with you and resonate with what you said there. So what are five things that we can do?
Yeah.
Because we're so good at so many things, as you've just highlighted. We can't go on at this if
you like. I know, right?
What are five things we can do to become better animal training leaders? What can we draw from the work that you're doing with human leaders?
Yeah. So the first thing I think, when you're working with other humans, one of the first things that you could do is start by building relationships. And you don't have to, you know, I'm not talking about being best friends with everybody or going out to meals with them after work, but you need to have a good working relationship. And there was a recent study in the Journal of Organizational Behavior Management by Scott Curry and his colleagues, and what he looked at was if they invest a little bit of time in relationships, what happens to behavior after that? Right? Will we get any sort of discretionary effort? Will we get any more behavior than if we just did nothing on the relationship building side? And what they found was in their experiment that just by spending 20 minutes with somebody before they ask them to do a task, they got the performer during the task. So the task had no feedback, nothing, no other mechanisms involved, but just the task for 20 minutes or whatever it was. Their performance was higher, their accuracy was higher. And then when they, this was part of the experiment, but when they did a follow-up survey, you know, a week or so later, the people that got the relationship piece, they filled out, they spent more time on the survey and they gave, they counted words as a way to measure discretionary effort. And they wrote way more just descriptive words and things like that, in that. So, you know, the easiest way to start, with applying behavior science is to start building relationships, get to know your colleagues or your direct reports as people, right? We're all humans. We all want to be recognized as a human. And so if you invest in that, people will immediately provide discretionary effort. And that's without reinforcement. Like, that's just an antecedent bump in behavior. And then that gets me to my second point. So it's something that I think is when it comes to humans, you've got to either deliver reinforcement immediately or you've got to pinpoint or describe the behavior well enough so that the performer knows what to repeat. Again, you brought up tag, the tag training, and I love tag training. I've been following that for a long time, and I think it's extremely useful when it comes to athletes. And one of the things I love about it is the reinforcement delivery is so fast, right? You can, with athletes, you can click and reinforce a hip turn, right? And if you try to say, hey, good job, that's too slow. It's that they've already done something different. So the immediacy of the reinforcement is critical. And if we can't deliver reinforcement and positive feedback immediate all the time, it won't work. So in the cases in which you're providing delayed feedback, you've got to pinpoint the behavior well enough so that the performer knows what to repeat. Right, you help them out. Tell them what you want them to do again, and most people will go, okay, yeah, if you like that, I think that's I can totally do that again. The third thing is, when you coach behaviors, and when you're trying to get people to develop a new skill, start with only a few behaviors at a time. If you try to focus on too much, even if you're using reinforcement, if you focus on too many behaviors at a time, the reinforcement's so spread out that you're not building one particular skill. Focus on, maybe two behaviors at a time where you're taking, instead of that shotgun approach, you're taking a rifled approach. You're looking for those particular behaviors, or you're putting the the learners in a situation where they have to repeat what you're looking for, right? And get some repetition in, but stay focused on that behavior. And then, you know, of course, apply shaping, right? Apply the concept of shaping. If somebody's, you know, trying to learn something new, learning can be difficult, especially depending on how complex the behavior is. And so break it down into small elements, break it down into, you know, the little things that you can focus on and get them better at. Now think back to the running of the meeting that I gave you the example of with my one client. You know, one of the things we worked on is something as simple as asking open-ended questions versus closed-ended questions. Like something like, hey, you know, when you go into that work area, what are you going to be looking for that could get you hurt? Right? That's a question that we had to shape up over time and get people to, you know, help come up with questions like that so that the workers told you, oh, I'm going to look for this or look for those things. So, you guys know that, your listeners, I know all know that learning takes repetition and it takes feedback and reinforcement, right? Especially when it comes to human, that feedback component of, yeah, that's the behavior I'm looking for, right? It's that open-ended question you just asked right here that I think is really key. That's the approach you need to take to get people to learn. And it doesn't matter what species you're talking about or what skill you're trying to teach. You know, if you want somebody to develop a skill quickly and correctly, you know, take the shaping approach and build in opportunities for that learner to repeat the skill that you're coaching. You know, that's critical. If not, it'll never work, right? It'll take too long to develop a skill set. The fourth thing that I think is, you know, critical, or maybe it's the fifth, I'm not sure what number we're on anymore. But the next thing is the development of a plan and collect data. You know, we all have, you know, think of the shaping plans and things like that that we have in place, you know, for training our animals and for developing skill sets. Well, you know, you can use that same approach and that same concept, you know, with our human learners, right? And if you're trying, whatever skill set you're trying to develop, you can develop a plan, which will make it easier for you to provide feedback. It'll make it easier for you to know what to look for. And it will make it easier for you to collect behavior and, you know, see behavior change happen, over time. Right. Because as we all know, you know, behavior change, you know, it just isn't a step change in performance. You get that accelerated learning curve. You've got to collect data to make sure that the learner's learning. And if not, then it's time to take a different approach, right? Do something different because the rat's not learning, right? So you've got to take a different approach. And then I think the last one that I think is critical is just realizing that, you know, in most organizations today, there's a lack of positive reinforcement. Just in general, right? Think about, you know, what it looked like before maybe the Industrial Revolution. Like, what did working look like? Well, you know, if you made furniture, right? You got wood together and you cut that wood and you made the grooves and you put the grooves together and then you lacquered it and you could look at the chair that you built and you could go, this is a really good looking chair. And then you would take that chair to market and people would come around and they say, that's a beautiful chair. And you could go, I know I made it, right? So the sense of pride of just, you know, people coming up and looking at what you made and being happy with that. And then them saying, hey, would you sell that chair? And you could be like, yeah, you know, I will sell this chair. And then you're able to feed your kids, right? So, before Industrial Revolution, right, there were tons of built-in natural reinforcement, right, for the behavior. Well, nowadays, right, for better or worse, you know, people don't build chairs anymore. They build one leg of a chair, right? They build the right leg of a chair 10,000 times in one day, right? That's what they do. And they sit and, you know, they do with that and they stand in one spot for 12 hours a day doing it. And so in a lot of companies, there's just there's a lack of positive reinforcement. And so anything that you can do to add in positive reinforcement or connect people's behavior to more natural reinforcement, then you're on the right trail, right? That's the sign of a good leader, is when they can pick out natural reinforcers and say, hey, pay attention to this. This is an important reinforcer for you. So those are the kind of the five things I think that you guys or the listeners might be able to walk away with and start small and do something with.
Yeah, and so, these are five things that for you as a listener are not something you've thought about before, or whether you as a listener were sitting there nodding your head the whole time and thinking that these are things that you're applying with your animals and you're seeing new connections with how you might apply them with your human learners. For me, it's really refreshing just to hear someone who does what you do for a living day in, day out, repeat back. And I've learned a ton, not to say that I know all of this, because I by no means know everything you've talked about today, but some of the things I've really resonated with me, and I just find my mind consistently going, oh yeah, that happened with a client the other day and their dog, or that happened with a zoo I'm working in. Or I need to take more responsibility with my human learners there, because I'm obviously not providing enough reinforcement because I haven't seen an increase in the behaviors that I want. So number one was start by building relationships. Number two, delivery of reinforcement, the timing surrounding that. Yeah. Or if you can't deliver reinforcement contingent upon the exact behaviors you want, pinpoint the behaviors with enough description so that the performer knows what to repeat when you do give feedback. And number three, start with only a few behaviors, otherwise the reinforcement is too spread out. Number four, develop a plan and collect data. I can definitely improve on that one. Number five, realizing that in most organizations there is unfortunately a lack of reinforcers. How did I go?
Oh yeah, that was awesome.
Did I get this?
If I had a clicker, I would click right now, because that was a brilliant list. Yeah, I think you're right.
Your reinforcement is non-contingent. Hey, thank you so much for everything, Brian. Sadly, we are now getting towards the end of this episode. We started off with you taking us back to where you kind of got started and how you got to be doing what you do today. I'm interested now to go in the other direction and travel into the future. And I'd love to know what you would like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years. And normally this question goes in the animal training world. But let's say with the practical application of the tools from applied behavior analysis and how we can use this to be more effective in all areas of our lives and with all learners, what do you want to see transpire with our science over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing for me, I think, is getting people who understand behavior science into politics, where they can make political decisions and make real change. To me, it's completely terrifying to me that, the politicians and the people in politics don't understand even a basic level of science and are unable to change their mind or to change their behavior when they're faced with overwhelming evidence, right? Which is exactly what a scientist doesn't do. We look at the evidence and we make decisions based on the evidence. And I think actually behavior scientists are even better suited for politics, simply because they understand how delays in consequences can influence that consequence value, right? So the longer you have to wait for a consequence, the less valuable that consequence is for many performers. And we know strategies for making that delayed consequence more value, and how to build in, even things like looking at behavior and tracking behavior, things like that, to make those delayed consequences more valuable. But in the next 5 to 10 years, right, we need people in governing offices that are willing to make choices that don't necessarily benefit them, but that will benefit the people 50 years from now, right? Those are the people that I'm really concerned about, is what's going to happen with our kids and their kids. What kind of world are we leaving them? And so if we want to create real behavior change, then we've got to get into the political system where we can create laws and do things that will be in alignment with what behavior science tells us.
When you think about what kind of world we're leaving our kids, we have to consider the influence of behavior science and being able to create the world that we want. And we've got political leaders that are not making decisions based on the lack of evidence. Can't think of any off the top of my head.
I know, right? No names to be mentioned, but
yeah. Hey, thanks so much again for sharing everything, Brian. This has been a ton of fun. Before we do officially wrap up, though, we've already mentioned it in the episode today, but can you please just remind everyone listening where they can go to find out more about you, ADI, get in touch and learn more?
Yeah, of course. AubreyDaniels.com is our website, and there's a ton of information on what we do and how we apply the science and that I think your listeners might find helpful. They can reach out to me directly. I'm sure you'll put my email in the show notes, and I'm happy to field emails. So, that's the nice thing about what I do is, you know, when I'm not facing a client, when I'm not on a client property or at a client location, I'm at home. So I have some ability to, you know, answer if you guys had any questions or anything like that. I'm happy to help out and answer any questions, and feel free to find me on LinkedIn.
Awesome, man. We'll link to all of that in the show notes. So as mentioned, Brian, this has been so much fun from myself. And on behalf of everyone listening to this episode, we really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today and hang out. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. I appreciate it.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.